Welcome to the EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference Podcast. The EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference brought together the most influential IT decision makers and resources to improve the ability of higher education to achieve its mission. This podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International. We feature a panel discussion with Lois Brooks, Director of Academic Computing at Stanford University, Nicole Harris, Services Manager for JISC, the Joint Information Systems Committee, Ken Klingenstein, Director for Internet 2 Middleware and Security at Internet 2, Thomas Lengenhage, Project Manager for Switch, and Kevin Maroney, Vice Provost for Information Technology and CIO at the Pennsylvania State University. The session is entitled Connections, Stories and Dreams of Federated Identity.
Thank you for having us over here. It's a real honor to be part of this and to have received the award. We're ever so grateful to EDUCAUSE for recognizing all the hard work that's gone on in this area. I'd like to talk to you about change quite a bit because I don't think we talk about change enough in the US recently. But change was really the characteristic of moving to the UK Access Management Federation for us in the UK. We had a very interesting position because we already had a national authentication system in place, the ATHEN system. It was working very, very well. It was incredibly well used by all of our institutions, and take-up amongst publishers was incredibly good. However, it was proprietary. It meant that we wouldn't be able to work outside of the UK very effectively. We wouldn't be able to scale it up very effectively. And because of the model of ATHEN, which was basically a centralized database model, it wasn't widely used for internal applications within institutions. So we were really looking for something which addressed these issues and put us in a better position to work internationally and really solved authentication and authorization problems internally, as well as within the library space, and then increasingly working with Web 2 applications and into the e-research space as well. Selling the benefits of standards compliance is not an easy task. A lot of people think standards are just this worthy thing that maybe you can do, but let's just get on and have something that works. So we immediately had quite a hard thing to sell. We want you to do standards. Our thing is good because it's based on standards. That's a very hard thing to take out to your institutions. They want to know, well, why should we do it? What are the real business benefits for us? And how can we move forward? The UK Access Management Federation started operation in November 2006. That was about halfway through the story of federated access within the UK. Before that, we put in 3 years of research, basically talking to our institutions, researching all of the technologies, and preparing to make the change within the UK. We knew we weren't going to be popular. We knew that people were going to resist the change. We're in a very privileged position within the UK because we're able to centrally fund the Access Management Federation, so there are no fees for our users, which makes it sound like a quite attractive proposition. Come and join us, we're free. It's not necessarily the way that schools and universities see these things. So the main focus of the work we did in the UK was an awful lot of user support. And I think if there's one message we can take from the UK is put the support in, keep the support going. And there isn't one size fits all kind of support. So we looked at an awful lot of different angles to enable our institutions to get on board with Shibboleth, to get on board with the SAML standard, and to get on board with the UK Access Management Federation. We did direct installations for some of our institutions. We actually sent people out to the smaller institutions and they did the installations of Shibboleth for them. They also trained up staff within the organisation, so we weren't just leaving them with a black box they knew nothing about, but we were upskilling their staff as well. So upskilling of staff within those institutions became really, really important to us. We did training courses aimed at novices, training courses aimed at people who are already very technically savvy, training courses for senior managers, training courses for service providers, you name it, we trained people on it. We also encouraged the creation of affordable external support organisations that the community could use. We recognised that the open source model was absolutely great and fantastic for a lot of our institutions, but not everyone was going to be able to do it. Some people were going to need help, and some people were going to need to be able to pay for that help. We're really pleased that we have a lot of organisations in the UK who can offer this kind of support to our institutions now. They've come on board, they've been great at working with us, and we have this real sense of community with all of those people who are there offering support out to our institutions. We took the support even further. My team went right down to receiving resource lists from our institutions, and there's about 641 institutions that we were supporting at JISC, and we invited all of them to send us a list of all of the resources that they were interested in federating, and we went through those lists and told them exactly which ones were compliant, which ones weren't compliant, updated them for them. I think the message I'm giving here is you just have to give that relentless support to those institutions if you really want them to achieve this goal. The sector in the UK is really behind the UK Access Management Federation now. We've got most of our major organisations on board. We get fantastic support from our professional bodies like SCONEL, who represent the library community within the UK, and USISA, who represent the IT directors. They've been brilliant at supporting us in all of our efforts. So now we can say that we're really pleased with the uptake. We have 100% of our universities on board. We have around 75% of our community colleges on board, and we're really pleased that all of that support has actually paid off. I think my final point would be the need to support multiple technologies. We will accept any sound or compliant technology within the UK Federation as long as it's been tested by the Federation and we know that it can meet our compliance standards. We really wanted to focus on being standards compliant and technology neutral, so we weren't closing our market off to everyone. However, this creates interesting new challenges when the Federation itself needs to move on, when we need to start engaging with some of the things that Ken's going to be talking about a bit later on. When we want to upgrade and move forward with the Federation, how do we make sure that all of these SAML-compliant technology providers remain compliant as SAML moves on and as the Federation moves on and as technology moves on? I'll be really interested in hearing your comments on that later. Thank you very much. I'm now going to pass over to Lewis.
And to Thomas.
Oh, sorry, to Thomas.
Welcome also from my side. My name is Thomas Lenkenhager from Switch, and probably you don't really know what Switch is. It's the Swiss National Research and Education Network. So we provide internet connectivity to the university since about 20 years in Switzerland. Where did it start with AI? That was in 1999, in fact, where the idea came up that something of a coordination for authentication at the home campus is required and would be a good use case for adding new services. The origin of that idea was really a 4 years nationally funded project for developing content for learning management systems. And the good part of that national funded project was at least three institutions had to join together to develop a single content module. So from the beginning it was clear more than one university will use it, finally. And so from the beginning it was clear some solution for authentication to these different learning management systems, because that wasn't prescribed which one to use, to enable authentication for these users from the different universities. So that was really the good thing with that. We had all universities really interested in a solution of the problem, because they were all facing at that time already problem which was approaching them and they didn't have a ready-made solution for. In 1999, we keyed the term AAI, and we deliberately left out the third A for accounting, which was used as AAA at that time already. The use case wasn't really there for accounting, so we replaced it with infrastructure because we wanted to build something similar like the network infrastructure also for the authentication. So that's where we started. And where are we now? We have currently 270,000 enabled accounts. That's a rough estimation. And as a comparison, Switzerland has 7.5 million people living in Switzerland. The coverage in higher academic education is more than 95% at the moment. All universities in Switzerland are on board since 2007. Smaller universities of applied sciences or teacher education universities are missing at the moment and being added as time continues. So our federation has currently 370 service providers in place. So servers where web applications are AI protected, as we say, and 42 institutions authenticate users for being able to use AI. Another number, about every 3 seconds, we see now a request on our discovery service. So for user authentication, that's a rough estimate where you can see where we are at the moment. But more important than where we are really is why we think we were really successful in establishing AI and perhaps what could help you as well in your case when you want to build up a federation, unless you are from the US where already in common also exists. I think it was primarily the good use case we had with this national funded project. So that was from the beginning clear, we have a problem, we need to solve it, and we don't know really how to solve it. The second most important thing was the community involvement we got in that. So the solution, AI, the implementation of AI, wasn't just the work of Switch as a national body, but it was really a community effort with contributions from all the universities, and that was from the beginning, from the phase. That made it really also acceptable once a solution was ready, because the people knew from the beginning what is coming, and it was designed to fit also their needs. It wasn't just developed by some third party. And then a third point, I think, is the funding which got available. Based on a research study we made, we were able to get some national money in order to deploy and roll out the AI to the universities. That money was given out on a matching fund basis, so universities had to pay half of the amount themselves, and the other half they got. So they didn't invest into something they didn't want to use, finally. Even more important than the funding was really the availability of Shibboleth, the technology. That was just really luck. We were not too early, but also not too late in approaching our problem. But in 2003, in January 2003, we decided to use Shibboleth technology. Even if it was rather early stage of the software at that time, it did work. You could demonstrate some things, but it wasn't really ripe yet for a deployment. But we just believe that it's the right way forward based on an open standard. And the collaboration with Internet 2 was always very great with Shibboleth, on the basis of Shibboleth. Another success factor, I think, is that we built into our federation from the beginning some support for privacy protection. You should really take care for the privacy of your users, of the data about your users. Some universities made it clear from the beginning it's really important for them that a solution is also planned and implemented. That's on one side that you can control the release of the attributes in some scalable way, so that you know for which service provider which set of attributes is really required, and only that set of attributes gets released and not more than really needed. And on the other hand, also the possibility to have user consent for the release of the attributes. For that, we implemented then a module for Shibboleth, an extension for the Shibboleth identity provider, UApprove, which is open source and will be integrated into the next Shibboleth identity provider release next year. These were the factors, I think, which made it successful, and I hope we can continue and also grow beyond our national borders, as we are currently limited in as our federation, but more on that comes later on than I can.
So InCommon is different from Switch and JISC in that InCommon, while we use much of the same technology and there's much of the same technology story, InCommon is a consortium of all of us. It's a consortium of universities, of our partners, both in the public and private sector. The driver in the U.S. didn't come centrally. It really came grassroots from all of us, coming from, you know, these issues with compliance, the law, changing laws, and higher ante on complying with the law and risk inherent in that, with the ever-increasing security issues we all face on our campuses. And then on the more optimistic side, on new technology that's been emerging that really allows more interesting and diverse forms of collaboration and scholarship within and without our campuses. The possibilities made through technology also then drove us to have to make sure that our data is secure and that our students and faculty are appropriately protected as they work in the virtual world. And so what happened is the same thing that happens over and over again in the U.S., which is a small cadre of smart technical people from our campuses got together working with most particularly our colleagues at Internet 2 and others from partner organizations, and spent a lot of time developing technology, working through policy, working through legal issues. I won't say a lot about it, but just envision years of work for quite a few people and tremendously good and thoughtful work. As you could expect, there's a pretty strong R1 research university footprint in these early activities for the technology development. So what's happened in the last year has really been interesting here. The last year has been a tipping point in the U.S. We've seen a couple things happen. One is that the membership in InCommon in the consortium is doubling every year for the past couple of years. It's really starting to spring loose. And we're seeing movement outside of the traditional R1 universities who adopt new forms of middleware early. Typically, it's moving out into the community colleges, into the liberal arts universities, into the partner organizations that support us with the vendors, the commercial content providers, a strong hum of interest coming out of the government as well, and drivers coming from the government and our relationships with them. Looking at this movement from something that was in the domain of a few to something that's really showing a lot of utility in colleges, the Young Internet 2 organization, the consortium, pulled together an interdisciplinary group, people from the consortium, from colleges, from interested parties around, and had a series of conversations about how do we go to the next phase of serving higher ed institutions? What will happen over the next few years to make sure that the needs of institutions are met as we all start coming on board with identity management? Out of this came a futures report that's available on the In Common website. That was developed by a team of 15, 20 people from around the community and vetted very widely amongst technologists, CIOs, interested parties to make sure if we think about what sets of services are provided through this consortium and to each other, what activities happen, they're the ones we need on our campuses. Just briefly, what In Common is going to be focusing on in the next several years, the very obvious levels of provision of trust, the policy, the technology, the software, the legal contracts between us all that are in place now, both at basic levels, but then at what we call bronze and silver levels, varying levels of requirements and practices within, depending on who you need to collaborate with. We're also, this actually wasn't in the original plan, but something that came back very strongly from the community that will be part of the In Common Business Services, a digital certificate service. There's a tremendous opportunity for utility for higher ed institutions and cost savings by providing a digital certificate service, and it's very much in line with the identity management services. So we're working to put together a business plan and set of operations. The challenges with these, as we scale it up, this stuff is in use already on many of our campuses. We need to be able to scale In Common, scale the services without faltering, and to make sure that people can adopt without problems. And so behind the scenes, we're also putting in place training services, consulting services, the things that enable us to get on board, as well as the operational practices to make sure that the infrastructure doesn't go down that we all rely on. So very much a scaling of a small consortium into a larger operations consortium. And then finally, In Common is looking at ways to support other federations coming on board, consulting services, operation services for other federations. So we're looking at what I believe is coming from a small set of universities to a wider set now. I think in the next few years, we're going to see very widespread adoption, widespread utility for identity management in the U.S. as well as federation with our partners in other countries. And the last comment to leave you with, this is my prognostication. I think that there will be a point, and I'm not sure when it is, some years out, where we move from something that's a good idea and useful into something that becomes an imperative that colleges have to do for privacy and security reasons. And so I think we're heading down a path that we all have to begin thinking about identity management and thinking about our adoption and our local practices around it.
Thanks. I want to spend a couple of minutes looking into the future and talk about three things that will be part of the landscape in the next several years, and then spend 1 or 2 minutes just looking back over the shoulder at what's been done. The three things I want to cover are interfederation, collaboration support, and the DAO of attributes. So let's begin with interfederation. Many of us are veterans of PKI. PKI was spectacular in that it scaled. It unfortunately didn't work, but it had superb scaling abilities. You just couldn't deploy it on your campus. When we moved into federation, we knew it could work because we were giving degrees of freedom to the enterprises about how they did things. We just didn't know if it could scale beyond the natural locus of a federation. Well, courtesy of some brilliant work that's been done in the last few weeks by folks in the UK, folks in the US, folks in Switch, we now have some breakthroughs in interfederation, and we're very confident going forward that we're going to be able to handle certainly the technologies of interfederation and more than likely the policies of interfederation, and that's the harder piece. So as I look at this interfederation technology, you can actually see where GoDaddy.com, one level up in the protocol stack, is going to emerge. I don't know who it's going to be in that space, but there's now a very elegant and soon-to-be-coded solution to the interfederation space. And at that point, we will have at least the global technical issues solved. Interfederation at a policy level is going to be a little bit more challenging because we have different privacy laws. Some of us have different attributes. We have common attributes with different meanings. The attribute of faculty, staff, and student, as we've discovered time and again, means different things in different countries. That said, there is a path forward, and we're pretty excited that federations will not only work, but that they'll scale. A second area that's going to blossom in the next few years is in collaboration support. We weren't sent here to do federation. We were sent here to make our collaborations and our communities work better. And certainly federated identity is an essential part of that. But even more than federated identity, we need to have privileges and groups and some of the other aspects of collaboration, the access control mechanisms work. And today, every application does identity. We're training them to not do it. Every application today does its own access control and group management. So over the next few years, we'll be training applications, and we call this process domestication of applications. And so much as you've heard the word federation, we'd like to popularize the word domestication. And it was picked to imply a continuum of, well, you're now paper trained, can we get you to eat out of the food bowl kind of thing. In particular for these applications, what it means is that you look outside the application to some generalized repository for groups and privileges, et cetera. And at that point, you move from tool-centric identity to collaboration-centric identity. And I add somebody to a group, and automatically they can get to various parts of the wiki. Automatically they're in my list. Automatically they can go into the chat room. Automatically they can do other things just by the one process of adding them to a group and having all of those domesticated applications look outside themselves for this information. There's efforts happening in Switch in that, in the UK, in the US. These will become much more popular and common as we go down this path. Very important piece of the puzzle. So the third area I wanted to talk about was the DAO of attributes. We started this and everybody thought authentication, that's really important. Well, actually authentication isn't as important as authorization as the attributes that give you the access controls. And so we've moved now into starting to think about those attributes, who assigns them, how they move around the attribute ecosystem that's coming down the road, how they're used in the access control decisions. And we picked the word DAO very deliberately because this is a very organic process. It's not a taxonomy and an ontology. It's an organic, holistic mechanism. It's an art that we're learning about. How can we say North Carolina can assert certain attributes? How can we all run service systems on our campus? So we're ingesting citizenship. How can we use that information? Who gave you the logic to determine citizenship? Who gave you the business rules that allowed you to make those determinations? We're trying to capture all of that information. The use cases are fascinating. They're all over the place. The Federal Emergency Management Activity, FEMA, spent billions of dollars to give first responders high identity-proofed cards. So now we have all these first responders showing up at the scene of an accident. You know exactly who they are, and you have no idea what they're trained for. None. So suddenly FEMA is all about attribute aggregation. They're going, wow, we took our eye off the ball. We need to know, is this a doctor? Can this person deal with a chlorine spill, etc.? That's one of many, many use cases out there. There's a tremendous number of polling use cases where we'd like to know that you're a member of a certain precinct when you register your opinion about something, but we don't want to know who you are. And can we get those kinds of attributes into the ecosystem and circulating around? We're a little worried that the DAO of attributes is going to become the DOE of attributes, to quote Homer Simpson, and we're already at that stage. We're working with NIH. NIH has crafted a schema to describe people who work with NIH but don't belong to NIH. It has 300 attributes in it, of which they expect 20 to come from federated partners. You. How many of those are you capturing today? How many of those do you have a business logic about? So if we're not careful, the DAO of attributes will become the DOE of attributes, and we will have let loose something very bad in the world. We held a workshop at the end of September sponsored by GSA in that space. There is the entire webcast on the NIH site. I urge you not to look at it. It's very dry. It's very geeky, but it's real interesting to those of us who get off on that stuff. We have some principles of the DAO already established about minimum release policies, about late bindings of information to keep the information fresh. We're trying to learn the art of attributes now that we have a transport system. It's really about the cargo, and that's where it should have been at the beginning. I want to end with a couple of comments that were picked up over the years. I presented this stuff to an editor of InfoWorld in 2003. And he looked at it and looked at it, and what he finally said was really important. He said, You saw a different problem and you solved it in the obvious way. And I think that was really important. We in this community tend to see different problems, and then it's really important that you solve it in the obvious fashion so you can code it so it's simple so that it works well. We found a way to balance local culture and autonomy with global scale. Again, something that we didn't know going in. We changed the way security and privacy are viewed. They were viewed as opposites. Now they're viewed as two sides of the same coin. It was when DHS and DOJ came up to me after I did shtick in D.C. in 2004, and they said, we think you have some software that's going to help us. And my ponytail said, I hope not. And they persevered, and they said, oh, no, it's going to work. DHS and DOJ need to work with each other. We need to share information, but we don't want to reveal who our operatives are to each other. So your secrecy-preserving software is very important. And I thought it was privacy-preserving, but it's the same coin. So, in fact, that was an important principle. I think one of the things that we did also was we followed the principles of the original Internet wherever possible. You'll see that when you see interfederation. As it comes out the door, you're going to look at it and go, I've seen this before. It's BGP plus a little bit more. The last thing as thanks is that I think for all of us, it's been quite a ride. And we thank everybody involved in it for giving us that privilege.
So one way to pitch kind of what's happened over the last 15 or 20 years, arguably, is that, you know, so the internet got built and we scaled connectivity and we scaled sort of the fidelity of bandwidth. And now we've got something in place that is arguably going to scale our ability to manage privacy and our ability to manage access, right? And it's not going to take too long before we start to bump into inadequacies or brittleness in our public policies. What are you seeing within your own nations, within your own federations? And then how is it that you think that public policy, and this goes to Ken's interfederation question or issue, what is it that you think we need to do to begin to resolve this between nations' borders?
Well, let me just start with the mess in the U.S. We don't have national privacy policy. And in that vacuum, various states and various cities, and in the case of Boulder County, various counties have established privacy policies. And that's going to be chaos. You're going to step across a county border and suddenly have a different, we need to get your consent to do something. So the lack of overarching national legislation in the U.S. is going to be deeply problematic for dealing with our colleagues overseas. They're not going to know that, I'm in Boulder County. I'm sorry, I can't release my EPPN to you without some kind of consent. So I think Kevin has identified something that is going to be a very difficult space going forward, and we're just going to have to work through it.
I'm going to steal from Lawrence Lessig to answer this, really, because A, he gave me permission to challenge law this morning, and B, he's far more coherent than I am. I think we have a similar problem in this space that we're facing with copyright, with data protection laws. We're dealing with laws that were created a very long time ago and don't necessarily translate effectively into the climate we're working in now. We're dealing with an environment where users will quite happily go out and give all of their data away to Facebook, yet when we're talking about the identity management within institutions, we are very strictly governed on any information passing when it comes to the passing of personal data. We need to look at this space. We need to look at new and innovative ways that we can challenge these processes and find ways that we can improve the user experience without saying, I'm sorry, that's the law, we just can't pass this information. I don't think I have any major answers in that space, but it's going to be a really important one for us to tackle.
In Switzerland, we have a national data protection law. However, the cantonal universities, so comparable to the individual states here in the US, they might have their own data protection law for their administrations, and universities are part of the cantonal administration. So it's not always that easy overseas. But at least it's rather aligned, these laws. I think it's important to really go along the way, use the minimal set of attributes whenever possible, especially when crossing the borders. That makes it rather easy for the beginning, and more interesting on more demanding use cases, move them a bit later on, perhaps. That speeds up interfederation, I guess. However, we will have to solve this problem, and I favor the path Nicole just charted with challenging the law.
Please join me, if you would, in thanking our panelists, not only for their contributions today, but for the last 10, 15 years.
This EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference Podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International. Thanks for listening.